Okay, we're ready to go. Hello everyone, I'm broadcasting live, November 4th, no? Yeah. So we're trying Dhammapada again. I'm really trying with this, the problem is we're in cramped quarters, so I tried several things tonight, and just reminds me of all the troubles involved with this recording stuff, batteries and lights and big white sheets tacked to your wall. Anyway, I keep trying. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verses 104 and 105, which read as follows. Ataha ve jitang seyo yacha yang itarapaja attadantasa posasa nichang sanyatacharino neva devo nagandambo Namaro saha brahmana Chitang appajitang gaira Tataru pasa jantuno. Which means it's actually quite similar to the last one. Conquest of the self is better than the conquest of others, of other people. Atadantasa posasa nichang santacharino. For one who has conquered themselves and is constantly restrained. Sanyatacharino. One who fares restrained or controlled. In the sense of not giving rise to uncontrolled behavior or activity that causes harm to others and that kind of thing. Neva devo na gandambo, not an angel nor a gandamba, which is also another type of angel, I guess. Namaro saha brahmana, not Mara, which is like the evil Satan, nor Brahmas, gods. Jitanga pajitangaira can turn their victory into defeat. Jitang apajitang. Apajita is defeat, I believe. Jitang apajitang means turning victory into defeat. They will not be able to. For such a person. They will not be able to turn the victory of such a person into defeat. So, great verse. Shows the power of self-conquest. Simple story. The story goes, there was a Brahmin who came to the Buddha and asked him a question. I guess maybe he was a follower of the Buddha, or he understood how worthy the Buddha was, or how wise the Buddha was. And so he came to the Buddha, he had this question. He wondered to himself whether the Buddha, whether Buddhas, whether those who are enlightened, know only what is of benefit, or do they also know what leads to detriment? So do they only know about gain, or do they know about loss as well? Atta, do they know? Attameva janati udahu. Anattampi puchisa. Anattampi. Do they know only what is atta? Atta means what is of benefit or what is of value. Or do they also know what is of detriment? Anatta, which is harmful or leads one away from success, leads one away from what is useful, that which is useless or harmful, really. And so he went to ask the Buddha this. I guess he had some idea that the Buddha only taught people good things. He only taught, so everyone was praising how the Buddha's teachings would lead people to good things. And they were talking about how great the Buddha's teaching. Buddha would teach you, do this, do that. And so he hadn't heard the Buddha talk about don't do this, don't do that. And so he went to the Buddha, and the Buddha gave him an interesting quote. And I was just having a terrible time with it because the English is, it's incredible how sloppy they were with it. They translate fierceness, chandikang, as moonlight, which is well, I mean, it's understandable because chanda would be the moon, but chanda with the nda, with the alveopalatial ndi, anyway, doesn't mean moon at all, unless there's another version that confuses the two, but it means ferocity. So the Buddha says, gives a list of six things, and I think I've got them all down. And he says, so he goes and asks the Buddha, do you know about loss as well? And the Buddha says, of course. And he tells him these, he says, Atancahang Brahmana Janami Anatancha. I know both that which is of benefit and that which is to detriment. And so he taught, says, please then tell me about what is to detriment. And the Buddha says, well, then listen. And he gives this verse, which isn't the Dhammapada verse, but this is often the case with these stories. There will be other verses that where they come from exactly, we don't know where they've been recorded, we don't know, but it's supposed to have been said by the Buddha as well. So he says, Usura Seyang, which means clear, that one's clear. It means sleeping beyond sunrise. So sleeping during the day. When it's time to get up and go to work, one instead stays in bed and doesn't do one's work. Alasyang, laziness, and one is just lazy and doesn't want to do good things. Chandikang means, again, ferocity, so being mean or nasty or cruel, when people are overbearing and just constantly irritable. And then Diga Sondiyang is an interesting one, but I think, because Diga means long, but Sondiya means addiction to intoxication or addiction to drink, it usually refers to, and maybe intoxication is better. So I think it says something to do with drinking intoxicating drinks, and it may be a corruption, but I probably just don't know what it means. Anyway, but the English is terrible. It doesn't have any of that. What does it say? Long continued prosperity, which is ridiculous. Diga is long, but long continued prosperity is not a cause for ruin, except it can make you negligent, I suppose, but that's certainly not what's being said here. And then we've got, I think it's addiction to strong drink. Why? Because these come from the, or these are echoed in the, the Digha Nikaya Sutta. It's the Sigalovada Sutta, the discourse, the Sigalovada Sutta talks about these various states that lead to loss, right? And addiction to drink is, of course, one of them. Ekasadana Gamanang. So go, I believe, means traveling alone, which they just translate as going on long journeys, but going on journeys doesn't lead to loss. Going on long journeys alone can lead to problems. In the time of the Buddha, it certainly could, because you could get robbed. It was a big deal. If you traveled alone, just wasn't a good idea. And finally, Paradarupasevanang, which means chasing after other people's wives, which was apparently a thing, or is really a thing, no? People commit adultery all the time. Bad idea. Leads to loss, leads to disrespect, leads to loss of friendship, etc., etc. So he taught these things, and maybe he taught others, but that's the sort of things he taught. Certainly in the Sigalovada Sutta, he taught many other things that are to your detriment. And it's curious, you know, because he doesn't say gambling, and yet gambling is considered one of the things that leads to loss. don't believe it's in here. If I've translated it correctly, it's not there. And in the Sigalavada Sutta, it's clearly there. And that's interesting because the Brahmin is then impressed and says, very good, that's awesome. Well spoken, you're really, really a great teacher, and you really know what is a benefit and what is a detriment. And then the Buddha asks him, so Brahmin, how do you make your livelihood? And turns out this Brahmin makes his livelihood through gambling. That's how he makes a living. I guess he must be sort of one of these people who a con artist, right? Or something like that. How to make his, I guess there are professional poker players nowadays. It's a big thing apparently to gamble online. I have people who tell me about that, how they do gambling online. And so it's interesting that the Buddha didn't include it, but that is common to be very careful not to attack a person directly, right? So if he had brought up gambling, it would have. So there's a little bit. If you, as a Buddhist, you it's more curious than this Brahmin probably realized. He doesn't bring it up, but yet he wants to make it clear that gambling is in there as well, without actually saying, "Oh, gambling's going to lead you to ruin." It's as though he purposefully left it out, or it's it. This story, part of the reason for telling this story, is to. Or part of the meaning behind the story is to show that he didn't attack him directly. It's quite curious. But can be a really important aspect of teaching. So anyway, point is he tells him that the Brahmin says he makes his living by gambling, and this is the funny sort of inside joke that here we can kind of smile because we know what's kind of what's going through the Buddhist mind to some extent, that he knows that this Brahmin is on a state of loss and is heading in a bad way. Anyway, and so then the Buddha asks him, so who wins when you gamble? Do you win, or do your opponents win? And he said, oh well, sometimes I win, sometimes my opponents win. And then the Buddha lays down the law and says, Brahman, that's not a real victory. As you can see, that's the nature of victory. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. We have the saying, you win some, you lose some. That's not a really, that means on balance you come out with nothing, right? You never come out ahead. Or it's certainly not guaranteed that you're going to come out ahead. And there must be some other factors. Often people would say luck is all that allows you to come out ahead. And as we've talked about, of course, it doesn't matter whether you come out ahead or not. When you come out ahead, what happens? Well, you beget enmity. Your opponents are upset because they've lost. When you win, someone has to lose. That kind of victory is not really, he says, a trifling, or that's how the English translate it. We can't really trust the English now, can we? Parajayo. Yeah, he says that's a low sort of, I believe. Jayo, no, Jayopi, Hoti, Parajayoti. No, that's a question, sorry. Brahmana Appamattako, yeah, so it's a trifle. He doesn't say that's a bad kind of victory, or that kind of victory is actually leading you to ruin, which in fact it is. He says that's a trifling victory. And so he, in a roundabout way, he's trying to get this Brahmin to see the error of his ways. Provide him with some friendly advice. The Brahmin did ask, after all, what is leads to loss, and so he's trying to somehow tell him that his lifestyle does that. But instead he says, so to be very gentle, he says, that's a trifling victory. A real victory is self-victory. Real conquest, that's conquest, conquering yourself. Why? Because that kind of conquest, you'll never lose. And so it's poignant in relation to this story, the idea of being invincible, because a gambler, the win of a gambler is always it's always subject to threat. The next roll of the dice, the next deal of the cards could change your fortune, could spell ruin. Whereas, and much victory is like this, victory in war, victory in business, victory in romance, victory of all kinds is unpredictable and is unstable, is impermanent. It doesn't last forever. It's always subject to the potential of being overdone, overthrown. But that's really the claim that's being made. So this is how it relates to our practices. It's an understanding of what of the extent and the magnitude of the practice that we're undertaking. I mean, this isn't just stress relief. I was thinking today about advertising the benefits of meditation. And we're probably going to put up posters. It made me think of, you know, people really, really, it's really catchy to say mindfulness-based stress reduction because it's non-sectarian, it's non-religious, it's really something that people can, it sort of rolls off the tongue. But then I thought it's kind of, you know, petty to say stress reduction because that's not really what we're talking about, is it? In Buddhism, we go quite, it's mindfulness-based, or it's based on sati. But it goes farther than just reducing stress. It uproots anything that could possibly cause you stress in the future. There's no potential for future stress. Meaning you're invincible. And it goes beyond heaven, it goes beyond God, it goes beyond the universe. Something that goes beyond loss, something that can never be taken from you. We're talking about invincibility. How does this come about? Comes about by a person who is Atadanta, Bosa. Nichang Sanyatacharino, who is constantly restrained. It's meaning they never, when seeing a form with the eye, they never give rise to likes or dislikes. They see it as it is and they're objective. They free themselves from the potential for, they free themselves from involvement in this game of gain and loss, happiness and suffering. It sounds actually quite fearsome for people who are addicted to pleasure and who are caught up in this game of gain and loss. So it's something that you do have to kind of finesse when you talk to people. And people often make the accusation that such a person would be somewhat like a zombie, right? When they are restrained, you know, means they are just suppressing their urges, which isn't at all the case. This is, suppressing your urges wouldn't work. It's not something that is sustainable. It's not the true victory. True victory is invincible. Imperturbable. I was thinking about this today, the whole idea of the zombie, right? So we have this idea that a person who doesn't like and dislike things is just like a zombie. Their life has no flavor, has no meaning. But then if you look at people who are caught up, if you think of how the state of mind for a person who's caught up in chasing after things, the objects of their desire, how much like a zombie they are. How unaware they are of their own minds, of their own state. How inflamed the mind becomes with passion and hate. And how the mind just in general becomes inflamed and so is subject to greed, anger, and delusion constantly. Sometimes with such intense greed that they will do anything to get what they want, even at the at the detriment to other people, even at the cost of friendship. Sometimes give rise to such states of delusion that they alienate all of their friends due to their oppressive, arrogant, conceited nature. The level of conceit that we're capable of, the level of arrogance we're capable of, and how awful it is, and how harmful it is. And anger, how we can be so caught up with rage and hatred constantly, depressed or angry, or, you know, sad, afraid, all of these negative states. It's kind of like a zombie, like one of those zombie movies or zombie shows that everyone's watching. The evil zombies, how horrific they are. That's kind of what we're talking about. Enlightened people are nothing like that. An enlightened one is not is the opposite of a zombie. They are awake. They are alive. They never die. They're invincible. And so this is what we're striving for. It's something quite profound. You know, I teach meditation, now teaching at the university, and I teach to all sorts of people, and a lot of people are just in it for stress reduction, stress relief. And so it kind of pulls you in, and you start to realize, oh, it goes a little bit deeper. And you end up down the rabbit hole, so to speak, where you don't recognize the world around you anymore. Your whole world changes. I mean, it's not like it's a trap or something. It's just the sweater starts to unravel. The whole illusion that you built up around yourself and who you thought you were starts to unravel, and you see how asleep you've been. You're like a sleepwalker, like a zombie. That's how it should be. That's how it really is in meditation. You start to wake up and see, oh, I've got these problems. My mind has greed. My mind has anger. My mind has delusion. Oh boy, I'm in trouble. And so you start to do the hard work of changing that. That's what we do in meditation. So, and that is the highest victory. It's a victory that no one can take from you. That's the point of this verse, and it's very well said, as are all the things the Buddha said. So, something that we should appreciate and remember. Give us confidence that what we're aiming for is not something simple. It's not just a hobby that you can pick up and put down. It's something that really and truly changes your life, transforms you, wakes you up, and helps you rise above your troubles, so that even though the situation may not change, no matter what the situation is, you're above it, you're beyond it. So that's the teaching for tonight. It's verses 104 and 105. We're almost a quarter of the way through the Dhammapada. I think when we get to 108, that'll be one quarter of the way. So thank everyone. Thank you all for tuning in. I'm wishing you all the best on your path to invincibility. Be well. You still there, Robin? Wasn't live until then. What happened there? Google. Sorry? Just a second. Go ahead. Sorry? What did you say? No, the Hangout didn't broadcast. Just started broadcasting now. There's a new button that says post publicly or something. That's, I don't know what happened. Anyway, so I'm not going to move the camera, so this is the way I'm facing. How does that look? Computer's over there. All right, so we have questions. Thank you. Well, it's good to get feedback. It's funny, you know? I mean, I probably could never have done this without meditation. I mean, I think it took me I wrote that in one sitting. I've written almost all the chapters in one sitting. I mean, then there's editing that goes into it. But it really comes a lot easier. I guess also because it's the Dhamma, but writing things, studying, using the mind is a lot easier once you've when you practice meditation. I mean, I shouldn't brag like that, but it is kind of neat that you can just write stuff. I don't think that's uncommon. I think for people who meditate, their mind works better. Sorry, how old is she? 14. Well, I'd recommend potentially the How to Meditate for Children, and you can warn her that it's actually designed maybe for younger children, but she can choose. I would offer her both because adults have found the kids' videos useful. You know, they're quite simple. So I'd recommend my videos on how to meditate for kids. And but certainly she could also use the book. I mean, the meditations for kids aren't exclusively insight meditation. So it's more to the point to give her the actual booklet. I don't think it's difficult to understand. But you can also go through it with her. As long as you're following the book, you can teach her, explain to her how to practice. Sorry, better to practice compassion than metta, compassion than love. It really depends, actually. No, actually, compassion, as we're learning from the Visuddhimagga, is best used when you have cruelty in your mind. So, I mean, certainly you can feel cruel towards an enemy, but more often I would say you feel anger. Cruelty you might feel towards someone who is suffering, you know, or someone who is under your care, that kind of thing. So helping them is out of compassion. Like, I mean, just to give an example, that as a teacher, why? Because it's common, it's referred, talked about in Buddhism, not teaching when someone needs. And someone could use your teaching. So the Buddha had great compassion because he went out of his way to teach people who needed it. Sorry, say again? Slows down the evolution. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't say either of those things. So I'm really not quite sure where you're going with that. I don't understand. The evolution slows down the evolution of our rampant minds. I mean, dude, read my book. It teaches you how to be mindful. You'll overcome suffering. I guess, okay, if I'm going to talk about slowing down the mind, let's forget about the evolution of the rampant. I don't quite understand the context. But slowing down or guiding, I would say it does both. Yes, absolutely. But it does it naturally, you see. I mean, it's not either one of them. Neither one of those things are our goal, are our immediate goal in the practice. Our goal is to see clearly, to look so that we can see and understand, and that guides and slows the mind naturally. I mean, the mind generally, if the because generally the mind, our minds tend to go faster than they should. It also can speed the mind up, make the mind quicker, less lethargic, less lazy. Depends on the person. Too hard to continue? You should look at why it's hard. I mean, sitting still is actually not that hard to do, surprisingly enough. Sitting still is not intrinsically a difficult thing. That's not surprising at all. Walking back and forth, also not all that difficult, unless you've only got one leg or no legs. It's a pretty simple thing to do. I mean, I had one woman who had multiple sclerosis, and she would do walking by laying herself on her walker and paddling with her legs, like basically pushing against the floor with her legs. She could move her legs, but just barely. So don't talk about to me about hard. I mean, she had it hard. But what you're referring is to is not the fact that it's hard to do the meditation, not that the meditation is hard, but that your mind has something that is finds the meditation repellent or is averse to the meditation. And so you have to figure out what that is. It means you've got something in your mind that dislikes what you're doing or that wants something different. And there can be many reasons for that. It's often because of our addiction to sensuality. We want to be doing something else. It can be due to our aversion to pain when we have to, it can be a sense of boredom. I mean, they're actually all quite related. But how it appears to you, you have to figure out how it appears to you and deal with it according to that. Noting those things, breaking them up into their individual parts, and noting them. Depends who you ask. In our tradition, the noting is necessary. So if you don't do it, you're not really meditating. It's not that you're not mindful. Mindfulness is just a part of, I mean, it's a tricky concept. Mindfulness can mean many different things. But we would say rather that you're not meditating. If you're not noting, you're not really meditating. You're just sitting there. And so it's hit and miss as to whether you'll progress from our point of view. I know that's highly contentious, but that's how it goes with us. It's hard, you know, because I get lots of emails. And I've kind of, you know, just in the end, you have to cut some. You have to at some point say, that's the limit. So, I'm happy to talk over the phone, but only if it's related to your meditation practice. Now, there's lots of questions you might have to ask me. I don't know what your questions are about, but there's not much I can do to solve your problems. If you want to learn how to meditate, how to practice meditation, that can certainly help
your practice, help your life, your problem. So I'd recommend that, reading my booklet. And then if you're interested in, if you have questions about the meditation, problems with the meditation, then, I mean, those are the kind of things you should be able to ask on here. In fact, I mean, it's probably not, probably, it may be a surprise, but for me to say this, and maybe not even very welcome to say it, but really anything you can't ask on here is not a question that is really necessary to ask. Or maybe not even necessary, but it's just, it probably falls too close, too far into the realm of the home life for me to even really, you see, because then I have to give you an answer about your life, which has so many variables that I don't know and is so complicated that it ends up not really being the problem, and the problem ends up just being states of mind that can be dealt with in meditation. So in the end, it just does come back to questions about meditation. So that's what I'd recommend. Learn how to meditate and then start asking the right questions. Probably not a very popular answer, but it really does come down to that. If having heard that, you still feel that you need some private time, then I'm sure we can arrange it. In fact, a lot of meditation questions are private, but that's why we're doing these courses. So again, it's about prioritizing. So I have 28 slots per week. I meet with 28 different people. Well, right now it's about 24. And those are people who are doing 2 hours, or one at least, up to two, at least 2 hours, eventually up to 2 hours at least of meditation a day. And that keeps me pretty busy. So then I come on here to answer general questions for people who aren't able to do those courses. Anyway, I hope that kind of clarifies my stance. If you can get through to me, then I won't turn down a phone call, but I'll leave it up to you to figure out where to go next. Okay, then let's run before they catch up. Thank you, Robin, for your help. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Have a good night.